Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Mormon Matters listeners, thanks for joining us again for another edition of the Mormon Matters podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon. We are bringing you the promised episode a few weeks ago as we discussed the second coming, the idea of patriarchal blessings, promising people that they'll live to see the day that the Lord will come, sort of led to this general idea and discussion of, you know, it would be great just to have a discussion on patriarchal blessings in general. And I thought that was a terrific idea. And so as we found an opening in the schedule, I reached out and I landed my first choice of a guest here. And I know that lots of our listeners are excited to have Richard Bushman come on. Many of you will know Richard is certainly the author of important new biography. I don't know how new it is. What, 2 or 3 years ago now, Richard? But Rough Stone Rolling?
2005.
So six.
Whoa, has it been 6 years? Wow, that's crazy. I had not realized it was that long. But yeah, so the Rough Stone Rolling, he's been the Claremont Howard Hunter professor for 3 years, stepping down a year ago, I think, as planned. And Patrick Mason has now taken over there. But Richard, are you fully in retirement mode here back in New York?
You mean, do I lie in bed all day and eat chocolates?
No, I don't mean that. no institutional affiliation, nobody making you teach classes every day, or that kind of thing?
Well, we have agreed to teach a course, Claudia and I, on contemporary Mormonism in the religion department at Columbia. Starts in a week. So we've got one toe in the water, and then, of course, we're laboring away at our various writing projects.
Right, right. Yeah, your wife, Claudia, and you were a longtime professor there at Columbia, and so you guys have moved back home. And what kind of writing projects are you doing now?
Well, I have two projects. I'm finishing up a book I began long ago on early American farming that I call Farmers in the Production of the Nation.
Awesome.
And then a new work that's just barely launched on the cultural history of the gold plates.
Wow, that sounds fascinating.
Definitely one to look forward to.
Hey, while we heard your voice there, Jared, let me reintroduce everyone to Jared Anderson, who has been a very familiar, frequent guest on Mormon Matters podcast. Jared, welcome back.
Thanks. Very glad to be here. And Richard, it is so good to reconnect with you. I was excited to have the opportunity to share some podcast time with you.
Well, thanks, Jared. It's good to talk to you again after our various meetings at these conferences.
Very good. Well, I'm just glad to have both of you. And there is a reason that Richard is my ideal guest for this, and I wanted to share that with you. When Jared and I especially were starting to talk about having one on patriarchal blessings, I said, wouldn't it be great to have a sitting patriarch, be with us? And Richard is for many of you may not know that he's had that calling for many, many years. And so it's neat to have somebody who can kind of combine the firsthand experience of being a patriarch, giving the blessings, having those experiences, as well as somebody who can obviously just reflect and be so articulate in the broader framings that will come to it, as well as he's not the kind of guy that's thrown by you know, hearing of somebody's struggling with a particular aspect of patriarchal blessings or something. So we're just excited to have all the different hats that he wears come to bear in this. If you don't mind, let's just get rolling. I'd love to just start out and frame our whole conversation today as patriarchal blessings. What are they? What are they not? Certainly part of the piece of that will be how much of them are really, other than certainly we know of them as an intimate sort of exchange between us and the Lord as mediated through a patriarch. But there are occasionally these pieces in there that seem to predict some things about the person's life, and sometimes those come true and serve super well. And I know that I've had that experience in my own blessing of things that I feel are super true about me, and I've drawn strength from them. They've been things that have led to spiritual experiences. I've contemplated them. But for some people especially, there will be what they've considered to be prophetic elements that don't come true for them or don't come through for a family member who had been made this promise or that promise. And as we talked about in our second coming episode, many, many people throughout the church's history have been promised to be alive during the time of the second coming, and those things haven't proved true. So I want to talk about, are these prophecies? Are they simply pieces of wisdom shared from the Lord to us and stuff like that? So I just want to kind of begin with that. Now, Jared, did you have a piece that you wanted to bring in there as sort of our initial framing?
Yes, thanks. One reason why we thought of doing this podcast, as Dan says, because it's coming. And it's my feeling that patriarchal blessings are one of the most immediate aspects of prophecy that we actually have in the church from the members' perspective. We have the words of the brethren, which sometimes very occasionally have prophetic elements, but patriarchal blessings more than anything is, you know, God telling you basically what's going to happen in your life. And so I would submit, and this has been my experience for sure, that patriarchal blessings really function as direct prophecies about your life. So I think that we're doing a disservice if we don't take that seriously, at least acknowledge that that's the perspective that most members have, I think.
Right, that's the expectation.
So. Yeah, and then, sorry, really quick. In fact, I've heard of people even checking on each other's blessings to figure out things like the second coming. I think we mentioned that briefly in that episode. We're like, oh, so what does yours say? Okay, yours says that your children will be around. What about this? So it's kind of a checking against each other to predict what's going to happen.
Interesting. I guess I really haven't heard that much. I am, just to let everyone know, my grandfather was a patriarch, and so I lived in a home where from my age 13 to 18, every Sunday a few people would come by for a patriarchal blessing, and sometimes during the week. And so we sort of lived it, and it became a little less mystical to me to kind of see it in action and to sort of hear him reflect and hear my mom, who served as his transcriptionist, kind of share our things here or there. And so perhaps when Jared's speaking up like that, he's really speaking from a perspective that it just has never quite felt that same way to me. So Richard, when people come to you as a patriarch, or just you hear these things out there and they're really focusing on this prophetic nature of patriarchal blessings, how do you frame that for them?
Yeah, there's kind of a sensational impulse in Mormons. You know, they want a miracle in everything, including in their patriarchal blessing, and they want it to be, you know, an exact statement from God about what is going to happen to them. And so they look for every detail and sort of test it against what actually happens to them. Which I don't think is an act of faith particularly. It's an act of curiosity. But I don't think that's the way we should work with our patriarchal blessings, or really with any prophecies, thinking them as kind of reading the minds of the gods. In the first place, we have to realize that we don't have any of the words of God. Every word that we receive comes through a human mind. In the scriptures, from the pulpits of our prophets, from patriarchs, from our bishops, from fathers when they give blessings, everything is mediated by human experience, which means that we can't, in the first place, expect perfection. There's always the possibility of infallibility of some kind. So that to sort of hold these blessings up to that kind of scrutiny, strikes me as an immature way to treat them. It may be what we're tempted to do, especially as children, but I don't think it's what we should do as we sort of mature and really understand our situation, where we're all drawing on the Word of God, depending upon it, but realizing that it always comes through some other person. So I think that's the first thing. And I don't think the intent of the blessings is to predict life. That would be too confining. I always tell people that only half the inspiration comes to the patriarch. The other half has to come to the person who lives the life. And you have to find out what all those words mean for yourself as time goes by. Because, you know, they're never definite. There's no words that can describe what the future is going to be. Even if you saw the future, you couldn't really describe it adequately for someone who hasn't been there. So I think there has to be room for give and take in these blessings, and see them as sort of a promise of hope and possibility for ourselves, and not as a direct description of everything that will happen in our future lives.
I appreciate that, and so I'd like to hear more about your suggestions about a mature approach to the patriarchal blessings, but what do we do when the literal surface reading of patriarchal blessings does seem to predict very specific events in our lives? You know, I know it's quite common to be like, you know, you will get married, you will do this, you will be, you know, you have children, you will have... Mine, for example, says you will be called on a mission. You will be, and it says very specific things that have been extremely important in my life as far as guiding my choices. So do we, like, what kind of caveat, what kind of interpretive framework can we, like, why should we not take things that seem literal and predictive that way?
I had a niece who was told that she would be a healer. And she was very interested in the classics and had lots of intellectual interests, but she did not want to go to medical school or to become a nurse. And it blighted her life because she kept feeling she was resisting her destiny in not becoming a doctor of some kind. But, of course, there are just many, many ways of interpreting what it means to heal, or what it means to go to school, or what it means to go on a mission. All of these things have many different meanings. So I think it's a mistake to sort of govern your life simply on the basis of the few words on your patriarchal blessing. I think you have to let your life unfold and then see how the blessing comes to you. I think the blessing must be seen as a statement of your possibilities, of the way the Lord feels about you and sort of his hopes for you, rather than just an exact description of the way you imagine the future must unfold.
Let me jump in, and Jared, I appreciate that angle on it. Let me add a different angle that sort of kind of puts us in the same thing. Richard, do you recognize, though, that there's sort of either an immature discussion about patriarchal blessings that certainly comes over pulpits, you hear it in Sunday school classes, who knows where people get it up, but would you say that there is this sort of cultural discussion that kind of treats them more in the literalistic way that Jared's doing than what you're suggesting? And do you have any ideas about how we might lift the level of discussion about patriarchal blessings?
Well, I don't think it's necessary to lift the level. I think people like think of it that way. But you just set yourself up for trouble if when you think in those literalistic terms, because things simply don't work out. And so we're always in the process. This is true for every word of scripture you've ever given. We're always in the process of reinterpreting it and finding out what it means for us now. And if we think there's one fixed meaning to any of these things, we're going to be disappointed in many places down the line.
One thing I'm concerned about is if we are in this podcast being disparaging of the way that most members do see their blessings, like, oh, it's your fault.
Right.
You know, it's your fault that you're so immature, and how on earth could you have expected your blessing to be literal and predictive and so forth? I think that we need to give credit, or, you know, give due weight to the fact that there is, as Dan said, there is a culture of that expectation, you know, that people are coming honestly by these anticipations. One interesting, well, I mean, it's unavoidable, but me as a divorced person and remarried, of course, you know, the whole section on my family life had to be radically reinterpreted. You know, I didn't know what to do with that. But I think To me, as a someone who studies the history of interpretation and scripture and so forth, it seems like, I don't want to come across as too cynical, but it seems that the blessings themselves are framed in a way that does seem predictive, that does seem literal and futuristic. And because it doesn't work out, then there has to be a apologetic after the fact explanation of, oh, well, that's not how it was meant. And I don't want to come across too hard, but I think that we need to give full weight to the fact that there are history of interpretation issues that would lead to members very honestly and legitimately having that expectation, even if there's a better way.
Well, I don't object to them thinking that way. I think it's a very healthy thing to feel like you're in the hands of God and he's guiding your life. And the scripture certainly encourages to think that way. But I think it's also true of the history of prophecy that it is always being reinterpreted. That is, in fact, one of the chief roles of prophets, Christ being a prime example, but Paul and all the New Testament prophets and even the Old Testament prophets take what was given once and say, what does that mean now in light of our current circumstances? So I think anyone who takes the word of God seriously has to be prepared to reinterpret the word for the light it sheds on our life as we are now living it.
I appreciate that. And I should say, my picture blessing is like 7 pages, so there's a lot to dig into.
You needed a lot of help, brother. I'm only a page and a half.
Yep, it's true. I actually have Faust's talk, President Faust's talk open on your picture blessing, where this was like a Brigham Young. He also talked in conference. You know, he says, mine is like half a page or 3/4 of a page, and it's been plenty sufficient for me. But I should say that there are big chunks of my blessing that are very beneficial and very useful. One of my favorite parts talks about my abilities about empathy and communication, and they have been very meaningful and important in my life. And it did help me choose a career, because it specifically says, when you choose a career, you need to have these things in mind. And so as far as that wise kind of parental counsel, I have appreciated that on a personal level in my life. But at the same time, there have been some predictive aspects where I have really kind of crunched down to the exact wording and be like, okay, what does it mean if this is capitalized and, you know, this isn't, or what could would that mean about, you know, and that has to do with partly with second coming hopes and expectations as well. So that's been interesting. But would it be fair to acknowledge, Richard, that part of this reframing and recycling of prophecy is sometimes because it did not turn out the way that was expected?
Well, yes, obviously it didn't turn out the way they expected, so that you have to reinterpret it. But as I say, that's a very common process. The Lord has been saying he's coming soon for thousands of years. And you were always having to reinterpret what that means.
It's interesting here. I'm somewhat surprised as well as delighted, though, Richard, that the way you've talked here now, you haven't backed away from the idea that the patriarchal blessing is in some way very similar to prophetic pronouncements. But you are now coming in full blast to say, just like the prophetic announcements that we see throughout the history of time, including Christ's words and Paul's words and everybody else's, doesn't mean the future has been written. It doesn't mean that it's not up to each person to continue to do the work and things like that. So have I stepped over the line, or are you not really, you're not backing off the idea that a patriarchal blessing is prophetic. You're just simply helping us see it in a stronger, our own accountability way.
Yes, I think, you know, we ask an awful lot of the words of God, and we depend a lot on them. And, I live my life by them. But I think it's always the struggle to fill the space between what we are and what the words talk about. That is where religion dwells, is between the reality we experience day by day and this ideal world of God's word. And that's never an easy process. It always requires a lot of intellectual application and a lot of searching and questing. and a good degree of patience.
Then what value is there in these literalistic statements? Because I don't think it's an overstatement to say that in order to reinterpret and find meaning and pertinence in the wording of patriarchal blessings, you need to almost ignore the straightforward interpretation. And as a textualist, I'm skeptical of what's going on there.
Well, how is this different from reading any scriptures? We read them both literally and for theirs. I mean, what we're trying to do when we say apply the scriptures to ourselves is we're always trying to say, well, now, given those words, how do I relate to them? What does this mean to me?
But supposedly that's already been done with the patriarchal blessings because they are directly to us and only us.
Yeah, but obviously we have to, I mean, it's like when your mother tells you something, you always have to understand what it means for you. That doesn't mean that it's now patently clear exactly. Those thoughts are not your thoughts. They're somewhere else on another sheet of paper. They come from another mind. And you have to make them apply to yourself.
Well, I'm excited. We are getting right to the nub of a lot of things right here, right at the beginning. But maybe let me see if this ends up being a wise playing the director role here. Richard, before we talked, we sent along a sheet with some topics. I may be wondering if we ought to just go down a couple of spots and take a couple of these a little bit out of order to, you know, the calling of a patriarch. What is it that a patriarch is told, you know, when he's received the calling, what to expect? What is the sort of preparation that a patriarch goes through? I remember my grandfather, for instance, when he got called, it seemed like he didn't give any blessings for 3 or 4 months, and they, you know, gave him special access to read blessing after blessing after blessing from others, and he did a lot of reframing, I think, in his own mind about his own expectations about what his role as a patriarch would be. So I'd love any reflection that you might want to give in that, that would sort of say, let's back up from these direct questions that Jared and I have been kind of going after with you on, and just sort of like, what is the role of a patriarch as taught by the church? What is the preparation? And then I would love to move into, what is the inspiration like that you're receiving? You know, what's in your head and heart space as that blessing's happening? And that maybe can help us get a feel better for this other stuff.
Yeah, I would love to hear all that.
Well, I was called in 1989 by Elder Russell Nelson. That's many years ago. I've given over 850 blessings since that time. Not recently. I've moved, and when you move, you no longer are a patriarch. So I've given blessings to my grandchildren, but not to anyone else for 4 years. And there's also now a patriarch in New York, so I probably won't serve here for the time being. So I don't remember all the details. I do remember being encouraged to read blessings, and that helps a lot, and to read the scriptures where blessings are given by ancient patriarchs, and to read about the 10 tribes. And so we got launched. Claudia's father, who had been an experienced church leader, a bishop, a stake president, and his son, would not give a blessing for 6 months. He was so uneasy about it. You do feel very strongly that you must live a pure life. You recognize that if you are not open in the right way, that you can never do this. So in a sense, it's humbling to take it upon yourself to speak for the Lord. But in my case, I just launched in. I wasn't reluctant. I just started. But the best instruction I received was from a visiting general authority who gathered the patriarchs together, as they often do during state conferences. I call it the senility check. Or you're not over the edge. But he said, in fairly dramatic fashion, he says, the brethren have just one thing they want me to tell you, patriarchs, and that is, give voice to the spirit of prophecy. And that was useful for me because I was very much aware of all the problems that Jared has raised. What if you predict too much and it doesn't work out and people will be disillusioned and lose faith in the whole process, lose faith that God can speak, et cetera, lots of repercussions. So I would edit my blessings before I spoke the words. Something came to mind, I'd say, I'd have to be a little careful about that. So I'd soften or do this or that. And after I heard this counsel, I realized that my job was not to give a sensible blessing that would wear through time, but to hearken to the spirit that came to me and just speak boldly whatever words came to mind. So that's really what I try to do. I will tell you, for that reason, the hardest blessings I have to give are to the people I know best. I've blessed all my grandchildren, and I know too much about them. There are too many things I already yearn for them. And so I have difficulty just listening to the promptings I receive rather than giving them sort of grandfatherly advice. And I've actually been quite disappointed with my blessings. I get tongue-tied. The last blessing I gave, I've never edited a blessing in the transcription so much as I did that one. I couldn't get the words out. It was a very saddening experience, and I can tell you I tried to prepare myself, of course, for these darling children whom I so adore, to do the very best job I could, and I had trouble getting around it. So that's, I think, the whole matter of it, is to give voice to the spirit of prophecy.
Wow, Richard, thank you. That's fascinating. Let's take a few pieces. You shared a lot there that all of a sudden I had to quickly write down some notes on. So among there, you said in the preparation process, you read scriptures and kind of the precedent of patriarchs in the ancient days, blessing their posterity and things like that. I want to spend some time there. Jared, I know you've been doing a little preparation on Jacob and the blessings he gave. Let's just do that for a second to kind of say that whatever today's patriarchal blessings are in the church, at least the intent, I think, of Joseph Smith in restoring all things and probably, who knows, it might have come out of this reading with this as he would take it to the Lord and say, can this be a something that we can have in this dispensation as well. So there is some things to learn there. So Jared, do you want to frame it for us a little bit about what you find in the Bible? And then Richard, any particularities from things that Jared might mention that struck you in that preparation process?
Okay.
Right. So the most dramatic example occurs in Genesis 49. So this is, Jacob or Israel blessing all of his sons who are framed as the 12 tribes, and we'll return to that when we talk about lineage.
Yeah, lineage for sure.
So this is important for several reasons. One, it, very specific prophecies and predictions. And what's interesting about Genesis 49 is it combines both blessings, admonitions, and even a curse or two for Israel's children. But really what it's functioning as is a prophecy about an entire nation of people, because these are sayings, like you are known as this, or you will be, you're, frisky like a deer or whatever. And these are predictions about what the role the tribes will have. And to get historical just a little bit, I don't want to get too complicated, and we'll return to when we talk about lineage, we'll get more into this. But Genesis 49 is actually a complex combination of quite a few sources, and the ultimate origin seems to be these little sayings about the different tribes that were combined into this narrative after the fact. So hundreds of years after when this narrative is set, they'd say, oh, that tribe of Benjamin, you know, or there's a really old saying about Benjamin being fierce, or the people of Benjamin being fierce like a bandit or whatever. And so that saying was written into this coherent narrative about Jacob or Israel blessing all of his children. But I think that is one of the first most important scriptural texts that have precedents that have led to this. And then there's actually this whole genre of what's called testaments. So there's the testament of the 12 patriarchs, and there are testaments of specific. So the sons of Israel give their own blessings, and this is apocryphal literature that did not make it into the Bible. So there's a really interesting list of non-canonical texts that draw into the same heritage. And Dan, you were talking about Book of Mormon precedents, and I think that's equally interesting.
Well, yeah, you and I in a pre-conversation, yeah. So we haven't on this podcast. But yeah, we were talking about Alma blessing, you know, his three sons near the end of his death. Obviously, earlier in the Book of Mormon, you have Lehi bringing in all of his sons kind of near his death and sort of doing it. So, and to me, it's this neat thing that clearly there was in the ancient world, there was a pattern of fathers doing this sort of thing. And we hope with their daughters, we just don't have a record of that as well. Would you say, Richard, were these the scriptures that Jared's mentioning, and then the Book of Mormon ones? Are these the ones that you found yourself looking at, or?
Yes, definitely.
Jared, I didn't want to interrupt you. Actually, you kind of brought me. You opened the door for me, so I jumped in. But tell us more about the Testament literature before we move on?
Well, one of the ones that is well known is called the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. Another one is the Testament of Abraham. So again, all of these are non-canonical literature written quite late. Often it's apocalyptic literature, which means, and this is quite interesting actually. So apocalyptic literature, it's prophecy after the fact, you know, veritatium ex eventu, to get all fancy in Latin. And it's this idea that you write a book usually to encourage the faithful in your day. Daniel is an example of this. And you use the names of people way in the past, you know, like Abraham, like the children of Israel, and these other figures. And so in these predictions, you know, in these blessings that these figures give or receive, it basically says the history of the world or the history of nations. And they use their knowledge of history to write that into these predictive histories. So is that clear about what prophecy after the fact means? That if you're writing, so if I were going to write the Testament of George Washington, and I would, you know, write all the way up until the history of the world, or the end of the world, you would expect that I would say a lot about the history of America. And then as it got recent, it'd get more and more and more specific, you know, talk about 9/11. I would talk about the economic difficulties. And then any guesses as how you date one of these?
When they start getting fuzzier and less precise.
When they start getting wrong. So we can date Daniel to a window of within 3 years, because they're predicting, you know, the statue with like the clay feet and the iron and the different materials, and he's predicting kingdoms, the Romans and the Medes and so forth. And then he's predicting the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes, and then he predicts the death of the leader who's persecuting the Jews so much, and he gets it wrong. It's really interesting. So in the Book of Daniel, we know that in 167, Antiochus Epiphanes defiled the temple, which is alluded to in the Book of Daniel, and in 164, he died. And the Book of Daniel, and this is a little bit off topic, but it's interesting how it works.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, how is this tied really to patriarchal blessings, other than in the Bible and in these literature, we seem to have people doing this funny business, or not? I mean, from today's modern perspective, we'd say that's not something that we would allow to be done now.
I think it's important, and I will draw it back directly into it. Is this type? We need to acknowledge historically that these testaments were written long after when they claim to be. So this is the point I'm getting to. So because they were written long after the fact and had this benefit of hindsight, when you read them at face value, they come across as predictions of the future. Okay. You see how that works? Whereas really, they're just written in hindsight. And so I think that that sets us up with patriarchal blessings as an expectation that these need to be predictions of the future when we don't have the benefit of hindsight. I think that's how it all comes together.
Okay, you weren't drawing a parallel with what patriarchs today are doing with the writers of these. Okay, got it. So right. Cool. Richard, any comment on that little side trip there?
Well, the thought that occurred to me is this incorporation of phrases and names from the past as a way of sort of enhancing the authenticity of the of these blessings. And that becomes an issue for patriarchs. I'll give two examples. My son was in a stake presidency in London, and the patriarch there gave almost the same blessing to everyone. And, the stake presidents are supposed to read the blessings from time to time to see how they're doing. And when they talk to this patriarch, he says, well, that's what I'm inspired to say. But the fact is that you have a set of words or sort of patterns that you begin to follow as you're giving blessings. It isn't just raw inspiration. You know, there are little frames in your mind that you work with, and these can become fairly rigid. So that is one of the problems of avoiding sort of settling in to sort of one way of giving blessings. Another problem comes up with the fact that many patriarchs are also temple workers, and patriarchs have to be cautioned not to use temple language in their blessings, because, you know, they're saying those words over and over again in the temple ceremonies. Right. And so they become part of their vocabulary. And so you can see the purpose of that caution. But what lies behind it is the fact that, you know, we all just have a certain repertoire of religious phrases, and we sort of manage them in our prayers or in our answers in Sunday school class or wherever we're speaking. And that's a problem for patriarchal blessings. It's a matter of the inspiration sort of crashing through your fixed schemas of speaking and really saying something that's fresh and applicable to the person under your hands.
Thank you. That's wonderful to have you share. I remember my mom mentioning a time or two as my grandfather's transcriptionist that he had, you know, he would break it up a little bit, but there were certainly ways that he would phrase something about a lineage declaration or things like that. And she didn't see any problem with that, but she says it was really neat when all of a sudden there was a total break from some of those things. And so you've seemed to just testify there and, you know, kind of my plan was to go back to what you'd sort of said in the preparation thing and do a little bit on the scriptures and the ancient precedents and all that stuff, but maybe really, You seem to have just testified that there are moments where it breaks through. Or would you say that there's breakthroughs in every blessing for you? So when you're actually sitting with that person under your hand, what is it that you kind of feel? What's going on? When are you confident? When are you not? kind of thing.
Well, it's a good question for patriarchs. We like to think we're inspired all the time, but the fact is you're more inspired sometimes than others. My concern, I'll say two things. First of all, patriarchs usually are very experienced church workers. They've been bishops, they've been mission presidents, they've been stake presidents, they've been fathers, and they've had the experience of giving many blessings before. And you need that experience in order to learn how to direct your mind to the place where inspiration comes and to know when you're in touch there. And I had sort of spatial images that if I can just get my mind in a certain place, then the words will come. But there's no guarantee. There's no way you can be absolutely sure that you'll do it every time. So you have to, you know, just struggle and pray the Lord will give you enough to be useful to this person. My great concern was not that I would say wrong things, but I wouldn't say all things that should be said. Mm. Often at the end of the blessing, no, there was something just beyond some membrane in my mind that I could just get through it. But sometimes it would come, sometimes it wouldn't. And then I would say, and the Lord has many other blessings in store for you, which I cannot tell you now, is, trying to say, look, this is an incomplete transcript of what should be said about your life. So it isn't, maybe some patriarchs get so experienced that it's no problem for them, but being kind of a worldly person myself who constantly has to fight for inspiration, it wasn't always easy for me to get all the inspiration that I really wanted.
Wow, I really value what you've just shared there. I think it's easy to dismiss because it's entered blessings so universally almost as a catch-all cleanup the mess at the end of the blessing, and anything else the Lord wants to give you, I bless you with that too. But I really like how you described that there's these specific ideas that are just hovering on the edge. And one thing that I hope listeners will take away from this episode is the role of the individual as mediator in blessings, both the patriarch and the recipient, and how we all have our framework that we inhabit and use, and that we need to either transcend that, we need to understand it, we need to work within it, and most of all, from what I'm hearing from you, be very, very aware of it.
Yes, I that is exactly what I'd like to say. There are stories told of a blessing lost, or for some reason you had to get a second blessing, and it's exactly the same thing with the first blessing, which implies that the blessings are all inscribed in heaven, and the patriarch just conveys them like a fax machine.
I have heard people think that he's just reading off an angel holding a scroll in front of him. Yeah, so debunk that, please.
But this idea that everything that comes from God is mediated from a human, I think it's the heart of Mormonism. It's what we do together. It's not just knowing exactly what God wants. It's learning to trust each other as speakers for God. And I think that I, as a patriarch, can give a blessing that will come out of what I know and what I am that's going to be different from someone with another set of capacities or experiences. You can't in a page and a half tell a person's whole life. You just have to give them some little burst of light, which is, of course, the way scriptures all come. They're just little bursts. They're not treatises. They're not complete accounts of everything. So, I think that's exactly how we have to think of our patriarchs, as men who are called. It's because they have the calling that therefore they can speak for the Lord, but it's all within the limits of their own capacities.
Richard, this is making me think of the conversation we had after I presented my paper, Revelation According to Our Expectations. Do you remember talking about that? How you said that you were nodding the whole time, but it's just really tricky because you can take an idea like that anywhere. That our revelation is framed in the way that we expect, that we think, our worldviews. And that's what I've been thinking of as you've been talking, as how, and I love this paradox. I think the more aware we are of our limitations and the fact that our current ways of thinking might be wrong, I personally hope that the more aware we are of that, the greater the chance that we can transcend those limitations.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, Jared. And what has to be maintained in the face of all that is trust in those words. That is, we want to treat what we hear from our brothers and sisters as God speaking to us through the testimonies or through the words of the prophets and apostles. And in a way, we're all propping each other up. We're trying to provide guides and stays and nourishment. That's all we have. This is what we're able to tell one another. So we have to both trust it as the best thing we have to lead us towards heaven, and at the same time recognize that we're all in the same boat together. We're just doing the very best we can to speak for the Lord.
Very cool. I am thrilled with the phrase a minute or two ago about bursts, because that is really how my patriarchal blessing feels. There's a lot of stuff that I can predict that he probably said everywhere. And every once in a while, there'll be this thing that says something right at the heart of who I am. And again, I was one of these guys. When my grandfather was giving patriarchal blessings, I became kind of wayward at age 16 and a half and on to my early 20s. And so I never got a blessing from him. So I did have the experience of having somebody fresh and new. And it was interesting for me still to look at these places where it's a burst. But I do remember, Richard, either my mom drawing it out of my grandfather or whatever, and he occasionally would share that there were some blessings that were just simply remarkable. And he was shown things that he felt in his mind. And then the burst that he would give wouldn't always say, I'm now seeing a vision, but yet he would sort of bless that person to develop their qualities or their talents in this area, you know, yeah. That sort of had been, you know, given to him as something that he not knowing this person ahead of time, had a talent in. And of course, those were the neat testimony experiences when the family at the end is in tears and says, how did you know? But would you... Are you willing to share? And I totally understand. If not, can you talk in any kind of ways about particularly memorable blessings, or at least phenomena that were out of the ordinary than the typical experience?
Well, I do agree with everything you said, that there are moments when the words just flood your mind and they flow, and other times when you're kind of dutifully trying to capture sentiments that seem suitable. And I do remember some of those experiences when they came. My own patriarchal blessing, which is highly predictive, and has come together in every letter, especially late in my life. I am one who has great confidence in the powers of patriarchs to really have breakthroughs. I wish it would happen with every person, but as we know, the spirit listeth where it will. There's nothing that can be done. I do say when people come into a patriarchal blessing occasion, especially if they bring someone with them, that everyone in the room has to seek the spirit of the Lord. So I always have the person who's going to give the blessing offer a prayer that the spirit of the Lord will be there, and hope that we'll have some unity of soul in order to assist the patriarch in his work. So, you know, hope and pray you can have more and more of those episodes. And I always worry myself that I'm not an entirely worthy person. And so I'm not as deft as some of these lovely patriarchal men you see, who just seem so pure and crisp and dedicated and wholehearted. I have too many thoughts in my mind that clog my spiritual veins.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I regret that, but that's just the way it is with me. So I try to do the best I can despite my inhibitions.
Yeah, wonderful. I mean, something that in some ways it's sort of, this is always said about a patriarch, but I recognized it with my grandfather as real, and maybe you can share this or not, and maybe we'll just cut it if it's not, but he truly did never want to give more than like two blessings on any one day, because he always would be fasting, you know, the day of, you know, when that Sunday was coming on, when he had a couple. But he never wanted to give more than just because of the physically draining sort of process that it was for him to be so focused on doing the best he could to be the open vessel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was that a similar way to say it, or is that...
Well, I think patriarchs do feel that, though we have been told not to fast for every blessing. And I've given as many as four blessings in a day. For me, that's not bad. That's good, because I sort of get on a roll. You know, you get deeper and deeper into spiritual things.
Oh, yeah. Found the channel.
I suppose in many ways I haven't been a totally worthy patriarch, because I'm too involved in too many other things. But it's like all these church callings. It's always an incentive to be a more godly person than you are. You never are quite adequate to whatever you're called to do. So it's and that's one of the great redeeming factors in the church, as callings that are beyond us.
That's fantastic. Jared, do you want to jump in with anything, or otherwise I'll steer us towards lineage?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, that it's time to tackle that nice idiosyncratic tradition that we have.
So Richard, this whole business of declaring lineage, I know that there's... Well, I'm not going to... I'll go ahead and say it. I've heard some people believe this as literal. I am a direct descendant of from Abraham through this tribe. You know, going back there. Versus others that sort of understand it. And at least the language of my blessing is not so much literal blood as so much as this is the lineage through which I claim blessings, you know, sort of thing. So what again is the instruction given to patriarchs? What do you sense is going on with this declaration of lineage?
Well, we're certainly expected to declare lineage. That's one of the required parts of the blessing. There's not many required parts. That is one. And Mormons are very curious about lineage. They always want to know, have you declared any unusual lineages?
It's a little seeking for second coming hints, right?
Right. And, you know, the patriarch to Russia says he has all sorts of tribes turn up in his blessings, which fits in with the North Country stories. So, it's a fascinating part of it, of the whole thing. I think it's a very serious part of it, but I'm less concerned about specific lineages and, you know, spotting some weird descendant of some obscure tribe than some people are. I think that we're in the process of reconstructing Israel. I just don't see how you can say that. What does it mean to say the blood of Israel flows in our veins? You know, the DNA studies of Jews do not locate a Jewish gene. All you have are a larger percentage of Middle Eastern DNA in Jews than you do in the rest of the European population. But over the centuries, you know, every population bleeds into its environment and again gets the blood of the surrounding areas into its own lines, so that to locate an Israel through DNA would be extraordinarily complicated, because there, you know, there's a good chance a huge proportion of the world's population has some of the lost 10 tribes in them somewhere. And the same for Ephraim and Judah and everything under the sun. So my own feeling is that we're not, that the meaning of gathering Israel is reconstructing Israel. What we're trying to do is to reconstruct the sense of a people who are the heirs of the great covenants with Israel, going back to Abraham, who think of themselves as a chosen people with a high calling to bless the world. And that for some reason, that probably could be rationalized, but may not, that it's good to think tribally. That is, not only that we're part of a church, an organization, which we join, but that we are part of a tribe, that we're kin, that we're all related in our blood. And so I see the reconstruction of Israel, or the designation of lineage, as part of the reconstruction of Israel. So we have a people who not only think of themselves as the true church, but as the people of God, whom have a mission to redeem the world. And I don't think this steps outside of doctrine at all. I mean, you begin by all this statement about a chosen people, and then in the book of Abraham, anyone who believes the gospel is part of Israel. So you suddenly drop all the physical barriers, and it all becomes a spiritual criterion. So that's my take on Israel. I take it very, very seriously, but I don't think that blood or genes is the critical part of it.
I really like that wording, reconstructing Israel and everything that Israel symbolizes. That's one thing that Jesus was doing when he called 12 apostles, of course, is, you know, 12, his 12 followers were, his 12 closest followers were symbolically representing a perfected Israel that would be restored in its fullness during the Messianic age. So there's some good biblical precedent there. Dan, it is interesting how some of the wording says, not in these exact words, but basically you are adopted into the tribe of Israel. You're grafted into the tribe of Israel. Mine personally says you have been gathered with Israel and you are of the lineage, you know, of Ephraim. So that sounds more literal. And it is, it's fascinating. One thing that I like about what Richard said is this idea of reconstructing this chosen people that eventually will fill the world, this symbolic kinship framework. It can work no matter what the history is. Should I get a little into this? Because it's interesting how the tribes work in the Bible.
Sure.
So a lot of scholars, again, all of these texts are constructed after centuries after the fact. And there have been some compelling arguments that have implications for the way that Mormons look at the tribes of Israel. One thing that's interesting, Richard, would you agree that the Book of Mormon teaches that there's like this big group of 12 lost tribes hanging out somewhere?
Pretty much, yeah.
Because, you know,
if you visit them, they must be in a place.
Right. In 3 Nephi 17, he's like, you know, 2 Nephi 29 says the tribes, the lost tribes have their scriptures, which we will eventually have, you know, the quads will get fatter. And then 3 Nephi 17. Yeah. You know, Jesus is like, okay, I'm going to go visit them. They're lost. So working, it's interesting how literal and tangible we have it. So I guess I'll work backwards. When we speak of the lost tribes, we are talking about the descendants of the Northern Kingdom. So there was the United Kingdom of David and Solomon. And then in the time of Rehoboam, Solomon's son, he was kind of a jerk, and the kingdoms split. And there was a very combative tradition of conflict and a relationship of conflict between the Northern Kingdom of Israel and then the Southern Kingdom of Judah or Judea. And so Judah and Judea was traditionally, there were Levites there, but also, you know, mostly Judah, the tribe of Judah, and then the tribe of Benjamin. Half the tribe of Benjamin was down in the south. And then in the north, the remaining 10 tribes, in 722, the Assyrians conquered the Northern Kingdom of Israel. And so what superpowers, you know, military superpowers would do in the old days in order to quell rebellion and keep everyone behaving nicely is that they would pull the native population into their home territory and they would just move everyone around. So you wouldn't have these, you know, so the organizational abilities of revolutionaries would decrease. So later in 587, when Jerusalem was destroyed, in 597, 10 years before, they basically decapitated Jerusalem. They took all of the politicians, they took the king, they took the intellectuals, they took the priesthood, and they took them all to Babylon where they could keep an eye on them. And then the people who were left, you know, the more rural, the farmers, it was assumed that they couldn't make as much trouble, except they did. So what happened, that was the destruction of the Southern Kingdom of Judah. What happened in 722 was that Assyria did what Babylon would do much later. And Assyria conquered, wiped out the Northern Kingdom. And so these 10 tribes are the ones who were taken away by the Assyrians and then got lost. They just, you know, were assimilated into the other cultures of the time. So biblically, that's what's going on with the 10 tribe, or the 10 lost tribes. Any questions about that?
No, I'm glad to have that review. Thanks.
Okay, if we go back farther, who are the 12 tribes? And this is where it gets really interesting. And, you know, the pieces start falling apart and we go down the rabbit hole a bit. Because there is a compelling argument that the first books of the Bible, the books of Moses or the Pentateuch, the narratives that we have in them, that the Pentateuch was written in order to make a coherent national narrative to unite the people of Judea, especially after the people who left for Babylon came back. So there were the people who came back after, you know, like 50, 60, 70 years in Babylon, and they came back to Judea, and there was tremendous tension between the people who remained and the people who came back. So there's been this argument that one reason that the Pentateuch as we have it was put together was to create a coherent national narrative that we are all one people. We are all one family. We need to get along. And so the argument goes, not necessarily in that stage, but the centuries earlier, that originally there were these isolated tribes, these independent tribes, and they all had they revered these different ancestors. So one group would say, you know, Father Abraham, we had Father Abraham and we revere Father Abraham. And then a different group said, well, we have Isaac and we have the God of Isaac, and Isaac was this ancestor. And then we have this other one, like we revere our ancestor Israel. Another one, we revere our ancestor Jacob. And also on down, you know, Naphtali and Gad and Benjamin.
Dan,
so
baby.
Yeah, and Dan. Yep, don't want to forget that one. And so these were original eponymous ancestors that were not originally family. And then as they came together and had to cooperate and get along, these stories were put together. Oh, Abraham was Isaac's father, and Jacob was Isaac's son. And Jacob and Israel were really the same person. And, you know, all of these people all belong to the same family. So one argument is that this older group of like six tribes were incorporated as, oh, these are the children of Leah. And then these are the children of the concubines, and these are the children of Rachel. And so it was this way of basically making up a coherent story to emphasize the unity. It's a little bit like our Thanksgiving story, you know, where all Americans say, this is our Thanksgiving, this is our common heritage, where in reality, very, very few people have ancestors who were actually present at that time. So I don't think we need to tease out all the implications of that, but one thing I like about the way Richard framed it is that even with this complicated history, the idea of an Israel who is God's chosen people, who covenants in order to do the will of God and be a blessing to all the earth, is very, very pertinent, and that you can, very applicable. And I like that.
Richard, any responses to that? That was fascinating. I'm thrilled to hear that, Jared, but I would rather have Richard jump in before I do.
Well, I would only say that I like the implication that history casts a shadow into the future, or that we need a history in order to construct our present, and that one of our tasks in reading the scriptures is to try to draw out what this past really means for us, and how it was put together over time, of course, is the problem for the historical critical scholars. But for every believer, we have to ask, what does it mean for me to think I'm part of Israel? And I think that's the gist of what you're saying, is that these scriptures were created in order to have an impact upon the times in which they were put together.
One danger, I think, and I feel a little bit sad when people go too zealously down this road, is you know, because we can all think of ways that the narrative I just told collides violently with the Book of Mormon and the other revealed scriptures. But I think that's a kind of a mistaken view of history. I like, you know, you're a premier historian, of course, Richard, but I like to tell students that what really happened is irretrievably lost. We can never, ever have access to what really happened, you know, not even in our lives, let alone centuries and centuries ago. So history is a story about the past that helps us understand the present and plan for the future. And so one thing that I would like to encourage listeners to do is, whatever the history and the complexity, and even if there is not some literal historicity of this 12-tribe schema, this idea of us being family, this idea of us being chosen, this idea of us being a blessing to all is tremendously useful in our lives.
Yes, I would agree with that. Let me see how far you're willing to take that.
Cool.
Would you agree that the story you have just told, that is the story that the current up-to-the-minute biblical scholars tell about the creation of these scriptures, is itself a construction and has use and meaning for their lives? In other words, they are doing the very same thing that the people who wrote the Bible were doing.
Unavoidably. Unavoidably and without question. I completely agree with you. One way that I push back against friends who want to take the stance, however, who say, well, if biblical scholars are just as much theories and constructions and stories as what I have grown up with, then I can reject what the scholars are saying and hold tight to what I've always grown up with. So as, not that I'm saying I'm at all in the same camp as you, but, you know, obviously my career is also in the area of historian, among other things, I don't think that all constructions of the past are equally plausible as far as what really happened. And so, yes, scholars are only constructing a story, and that's their own myth, you can say. But it all depends on what we're asking. If we're talking about meaning and value and use, then almost anything is fair game. You know, if someone reads a cookbook and has an epiphany about how to live her life, that's fantastic. And I'm not going to devalue that at all. But if our game is to figure out what really happened, I will align with the scholars, not the history of interpretation. Let me say just a tiny bit more about this. When I was first in grad school, because I came into grad school wanting to harmonize the Mormon narrative of the history of the Bible and Scripture with the academic narrative of Scripture, and I realized that the academic can explain the faith position. It has a history. You know, there's a whole history of interpretation for how these things came together. So I think that what I like to do with this complicated picture of history, and where I like to take it theologically, so to answer your question briefly, what I think you're asking, Richard, is yes, I fully acknowledge, and we need to acknowledge, that scholarship is its own construction and myth that fulfills certain agendas. But at the same time, I think that we are doing a disservice to the historian's craft if we do not acknowledge that for the most part, historians are sincere, open-minded, very careful scholars who, in the light of new evidence, would revise their theories. And they're doing their best to construct what really happened, even mm-hmm. though it's impossible to get. So what I like doing with the complexity of history and the how it intersects with theology, it's not to say, oh my gosh, I can't have a testimony of the Book of Mormon anymore because of these biblical problems. What I like doing is I like saying, what does this messiness, this richness, this complexity teach us about the nature of revelation, the nature of the intersection of, you know, history and how God speaks to us? And, you know, we've talked about this previously, Richard, how I really anchor myself with this idea that God speaks to us according to our language, according to our context, according to our understanding. And so I think that we benefit greatly when we take this messy complexity and we say, oh, okay, maybe I shouldn't have these expectations of the Book of Mormon. As far as, let's use another really quick example. I was at BYU in 2003 for a summer seminar thing, and there were some people who said, you know, what does Moroni 9 or Mormon 9 that references the long ending speaking of Mark, what does it teach us about the historical, the history of how the New Testament came together? And I think that that is not a useful way to look at it. I said we need to look at what the Book of Mormon is historically before we use it as a historical evidence to put it on the question of, you know, how the New Testament came together.
Right.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that helps a lot. I think a loaded word is really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is a meaning of really if you're within this historical critical framework, and I agree with you entirely that there's a sincere effort and an honest attempt to really figure out what things, what the evidence means. I also think that that will shift. It's not once and for all, and there can be quite radical shifts. The way Isaiah is now looked upon differently as having a greater unity than before, when they were breaking it into three or more parts. So we don't want to think that there's a certainty that can be found through historical critical methods that we have to yield to under all circumstances. And it's also true that really can mean other things, such as what is really important or what helps us to organize our lives and recognize a kind of truth that may be as relevant or powerful as this sort of historical reality that that the historians are bent on recovering.
So I
want to shake things up and not, you know, have one person has the total authority and everybody else is just sort of playing around with their myths.
Right, of course. And this is why I think it's really productive. Sorry, not to use really. I think it's productive and beneficial to, and I think it bears the best reward or a very valuable reward for how we apply the scriptures to our own lives, just to realize what we've talked about over this episode where, wow, how do our limitations and our perceptions and our expectations and our worldview, how does that, you know, intersect with the way that God acts in our lives? As you said in the beginning of this podcast episode, that we have no unmediated access to God, even though some experiences can be more direct than others. At the same time, I think that we need to be humble and skeptical when we realize, I'm just really cautious when we have theological or interpretive reasons to discount scholarship. Do you see what I'm saying? That,
yeah, no, that we cannot do. That we cannot do. We cannot just cover things up and dismiss it wholesale.
Evolution is just a theory, right? You know, as if that's a way to dismiss it. Yeah.
Or like the multiple authorship of Isaiah. I think that we need to be very cautious whenever we try to deconstruct and weaken scholarship in order to hold to our previously held views of history and the way the world is. One of my favorite principles of textual criticism, and it works with history as well, is what story, you know, what conception best explains all available evidence, you know, with the least exceptions and as simply as possible. And obviously it is a reconstruction, but like with the multiple authorship of Isaiah, what you just said, Richard, I would, I'll bracket that example. Evangelical biblical scholars will often say, oh, well, you know, they will filter their academic study of the New Testament through their theological investments. And I think that that also needs to be spoken against, and we need to have caution there. So sometimes my friends will say, you know, with Bart Ehrman being my advisor, who's known for deconstructing that whole narrative, some of my friends will say, well, I found this other scholar who says this, therefore I can believe it. But again, I would like to return to the usefulness and utility of this. And I do think that it doesn't need to be one or the other. We don't need to believe the academic framework and therefore throw out the usefulness of, say, the Book of Mormon or Patriarchal Blessings. And we also don't need to throw out scholarship because we have the, you know, because Second Isaiah is quoted in Second Nephi. Again, I think that it's a rich area of investigation to say, how does the Spirit speak to me? How does God speak to me? How can I gain wisdom? How can I, as you were speaking of with Patriarchal Blessings earlier, Richard, and it's a journey of a lifetime, and maybe this would be another, yet another episode, Dan, is how does the Spirit speak to us? How does God speak to us? And I think that we can, it's a humbling, it gives us perspective in order to, you know, take the scholarly theories and say, wow, maybe we should be more open and be humble and learn as much as we can so God can speak to us in a way that corresponds with reality in as many useful ways as possible.
Fantastic. Thank you, you guys. That's wonderful to hear your exchange and all that. Just to loop it back quickly to lineage and that part of the patriarchal blessing, Richard, what I heard from you is you think there's a both and going on, that you're open to the idea of literal blood descent as part of this reconstruction of Israel, but perhaps you're leaning a little bit more important. So in case what Jared shared about even the idea of Abraham being the father of Isaac, who's the father of Jacob, who's the father of these 12 sons, maybe that, you know, if what he's saying is possibly true, that's a reconstruction in and of itself, you are saying that more importantly it is the idea of Israel, the idea of being under a covenant, the idea of having promises and responsibilities that come with the Abrahamic covenant, that's far more powerful for you.
Yes, that's true.
Very cool. I want to take us now into the final area that we outlined ahead of time, and this all came, I'll let you know, it came out of a, at least it was a nice reminder for me to get an email from a fellow after our Second Coming episode of Mormon Matters, and the tease that we had there that we would try to do an episode on the patriarchal blessings. And a fellow wrote me, and he's in a lot of conflict about his own patriarchal blessing. He says, I want to love it. I want to like it the way I did, but there's this implication in my patriarchal blessing, and he knows that it's a teaching of the church. He even provided some references and things. The idea in a lot of patriarchal blessings is that the patriarch will say, you are a chosen person. You are a valiant spirit in the pre-earth life. You, therefore, because of this, you were born to a righteous family. You were born under the covenant. You were born under favorable circumstances of some sort. And, of course, that's a neat thing for everyone to hear, that they're special and all that stuff. But for this person who wrote me, he says, "What is it, if that means the flip side's true?" He goes, "I'm not comfortable with that idea of pre-earth valiancy," because he says, you know, obviously he's thinking of all the racist, you know, folklore about valiancy in the pre-earth life having anything to do with skin color and things like that. And so his whole question is this a theology he has to believe, that Mormons or people born in America or, you know, affluence or white or any of this, do we need to keep this doctrine alive within Mormonism? And specifically, he's saying it seems to be such a part of patriarchal blessings that he's having a hard time with his patriarchal blessings. So, Richard, I just want to throw this out to you, if you don't mind, to just reflect a little bit on, is this a part of pretty much every patriarchal blessing you've ever given, everyone that you've read? Is it an impression that you feel like you get fresh, that this person is in circumstances in this life because of different, you know, gifts or talents or things that they displayed in the previous life? Or is that just a habit? And especially, do you know if these kinds of declarations are showing up around the world with different patriarchs? Or is this sort of just an American, you know, habit?
I've never used any wording like that myself.
Interesting.
I can imagine it coming from a patriarch. It's a fairly common way of speaking in the church. I think there are two parts of it. One is the idea of valiancy. Were you valiant? And I don't think people object to that notion, that maybe you did do something remarkable beforehand. But what we dislike is the notion that valiancy has a reward, and the reward is to be born in the United States in a church family under favorable circumstances, which implies all who are born under unfavorable circumstances in distant places, in poverty and ignorance were somehow lesser, that they were unvalued.
Right, right.
It's the Mormon karma or caste system.
Yeah. I think if you presented a Mormon with that dilemma, they would be very uncomfortable with the notion that their sons are teaching in their native land were somehow less valiant. We don't like the negative side of it. We just like the positive side of it. It's like we like to say we're the one true church, but we feel very uncomfortable if someone says all the other churches are terribly wrong. So, what for me, the issue is less the negative implications than whether or not it's useful to think of yourself as special, that somehow you were selected, that you are a favored soul. Does that automatically imply others are unfavored souls, or is it just a way of bolstering our confidence in ourselves and giving us hope and helping us to rise above the circumstances of our own life, which may be pretty grubby? Is it something to tell, you know, a kid who comes in from Harlem and lives in a tough family to say you are a special soul? Is there some usefulness in that kind of designation? So I have two questions really there. One, is it useful to be called valiant? And two, is there any way we can escape the downside of specialness by saying everybody else is not favored?
That's a good start on this. Jared, do you want to jump in with any thoughts?
Well, I don't think it needs to be a zero-sum game. One of the problems that's muddying the waters is the fact that we've used the whole blacks and the priesthood issue became mixed in with this,
right?
You know, where we, as an explanation for why they didn't have the priesthood, it was, you know, that they weren't as valiant in the preexistence, and therefore it became part of the Mormon framework to use this valiance. And I've heard of many patriarchal blessings. In fact, a friend just sent me a copy of his that I was looking at, and it talks a lot about, you know, you fought in the war in heaven, you were on the front lines, you know, Michael, the great archangel, wants to give you a high five and he misses you. But do you know what I mean? Like, there's very much whole, and then there's the problematic aspect of like, well, then this generation is the very most chosen. There's we use our doctrine of pre-existence as a way to bolster our importance. And then there's this, especially with the day of the war in heaven, for some reason, like a lot. I've several that I've seen where it's like, you know, you were a general and you were on the front lines, and we want to feel significant and important as human beings. So I think those are a few things at play. I agree with Richard I don't know how there's a way to say, well, like, you are on the front lines, you are a general, you are chosen, you are special. I don't know how we can not also own the flip side of that coin, which is there are others who weren't as valiant, who weren't, and, you know, who aren't as special. I think we would all agree that God loves all of us. You know, God loves all of us, and we are special and cherished to him, and we see it relationally. But we also need to confront the fact that we have this in our heritage, you know, this idea that some are not as valiant as others.
Right.
I would say that I think for most Latter-day Saints, that may initially take a racial or a national view. But if anybody in the whole wide world, from any of the most remote places, the most deprived people, were to join the church, whatever their skin color, whatever their culture, and they received a patriarchal blessing, they're just as likely to be told they're a valiant angel from the wars in heaven as someone who grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Yeah, and theirs is a special calling to be where they are in those circumstances.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me ask this, Richard, with your idea of bursts of inspiration and things like this, and also patriarch having a framing. You have said that you don't talk pre-existence in your blessings. Yet I'm getting the impression that you don't shy away from telling the person you are special, but you just don't tie it to preexistence. So how would you frame a patriarch who does some of these really really elaborate discussions, like Jared says, about being a general and things like that? I'm trying to predict in my head what you'd said. You'd say something like, this person obviously really enjoys the pre-earth life thinking, and yet he could marry a burst that, you know, is a burst of feeling from Heavenly Father for how wonderful and strong this spirit is, and he would sort of map that onto that narrative, where you would get the same burst about this person, and you just would choose not to map it onto that framing. Does that seem right?
Well, yeah, you've got it exactly right. I mean, the our form of the gospel has just a very rich repertoire of images and events that we can call on to sort of explain our feelings and where we think we're headed. And so I don't really object to people using that fairly dramatic kind of language. It communicates and has great power. My own way of putting that is that when I'm talking to people ahead of time, which is almost as important as the blessing itself, I say to them that it's very easy for people to think of themselves negatively, that they think they've failed, that they've made mistakes, that they have weaknesses they cannot overcome, that their lives seem blighted. I mean, we all have two stories for ourselves. Sometimes we're the greatest in the world, but we can also think of ourselves as just horrible failures. But in all the blessings I have given, I cannot think of but one or two that weren't overwhelmingly positive. And that for me, what this says is that our Heavenly Father thinks of us with greater hope and confidence than we may think of ourselves. And one of the great functions of a blessing is to remind us of our possibilities as the children of God to grow and do mighty and wonderful things in the world.
Oh, fantastic. I love that.
Oh, I love that. Like, I don't want to bring in I want to end on that such a beautiful positive note. I was thinking about what I want to follow up with on this whole, we have inspiration, we have ideas that we want to get across, and then we put it in a certain framing. And I have heard of blessings where people are promised that they will. This one I was looking at actually said that he will control the elements and raise the dead and be present at Adam on Diamon. I do think that we need to acknowledge. So how we would reframe that according to the model you brought up, Dan, is we could say, okay, so the patriarch is really enthusiastic about the second coming, and therefore here is the meaning behind that. I just want to bring up the fact that that is a pretty hefty level of deconstruction required to get at the useful nuggets. And that I don't think our culture encourages that kind of framework. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, we, all three of us here, are comfortable with that because of our training, among other things. But that is a very high cost. Like, it's very expensive to be able to do that to your blessing, is what I'm saying. To completely deconstruct the surface of what it says in order to reconstruct the deeper. And I think it's a beneficial path, but it's also it's tough.
Well, I'm with you on that. That's one of my deepest concerns. I mean, we have lived in an environment where we're constantly assaulted with questions and doubts, and so we're striving to find something that can reconcile what we truly and deeply believe and want to hold on to with all the issues that are thrust upon us by our academic setting. So we sort of move into this interpretive mode. And there's always the question, are we somehow deracinating the gospel, or are we draining it of its zest and force by sort of reducing the literal force of these words? That's what you were getting at the first, I think, Jared, when you were responding to some of my reactions. And I always am concerned about that, But the best I can say is that I'm doing the best I can to make sense of the gospel in a way that works in my life. And all I can do is bear a single testimony. This is what it means to me. And to hope that there are other kinds of testimonies being born all over the church by people who are in a different framework altogether, that will somehow achieve the same end.
Ah, I like it.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. I want to be fair to everyone and everyone's experience. And the point that I want to emphasize is I, like you, Richard, in a different way, am fighting very, very hard for relevance. And I want to dig deeply into the relevance of religion, the relevance of Mormonism. And I have interpretive frameworks that I have been thinking about that are very useful to me. But I think what I don't want listeners or members in general to get is, oh, darn, you know, because this did not naturally occur to me, I must be a failure. I must be falling short. And I think that we need to acknowledge that these interpretive frameworks that I believe have a lot of richness are not taught in the mainstream church. And I wish they would be. I really wish they would be. I have some strong feelings about what it is going to take to bring the church forward into the next 50 years, because we are dealing with so many tremendous, tremendous paradigm shifts. And I'm hopeful. Like, I'm hopeful. But I wish that the church would harness. And Richard, you have had amazing opportunities to be right in the front lines of all of this. But I just hope that the church will allow and encourage these alternative frameworks that map onto life and reality in more beneficial ways with less cost. Yeah. Less cost that will leave people feeling disillusioned, feeling betrayed, feeling let down, and yet will also enable them to benefit from every good and uplifting and rich legacy of Mormonism that we have. And part of that, and I just want to say as kind of a concluding bit, I love my patriarchal blessing. I really do. I'm grateful for it. I want my children to have patriarchal blessings. It has been, and some of it I have had to deconstruct and think differently about it. But in the end, I really think it's been a benefit for me.
I think that's a lovely conclusion, Jared.
Yes, thank you. Richard, I want you to share whatever you have left at the end. I wanted to just bring a little close to the pre-existence discussion again. This fellow that wrote seemed to be mostly concerned with the negative side. If there's the positive implication of valiancy, there's a negative one. Richard, you've gone out of your way to say you don't think you need to go there. So if I hope to the writer of that, I'd give his name, but I didn't ask his permission ahead of time. So he just asked for us to include that. But he did make a positive theological point, and so I just wanted to give word to that. Quoting from one of his paragraphs here, he says, We're all God's creations. I don't know of any clear reference to the preexistence in the Bible or the Book of Mormon. Instead, the overall message is for us to become the children of God. And so his positive framing on it, rather than saying anything about your past, is that the future ahead of us is always to have that deepened relationship to where you would, you know, grow into this positive relationship with God. So mm-hmm. I wanted to give his positive frame there, and I truly do hope that he and anybody else who's struggling with their patriarchal blessing, even as Jared says, is very positive in his life, very positive in my life. And I think I shared with you guys in some pre-conversation that two of my wowie zowie biggest spiritual moments of my life came from just looking at an interesting turn of phrase in that patriarchal blessing that didn't sound like normal language or something, and you know, really diving in, what does this mean, and having really important things shared with me, at least things that I feel were of deep wisdom about who I was and different things that have helped me. So I'm with Jared in a very positive thing. So, Richard, if I could just ask you to close with whatever you'd want to say, if you were to just sum up your life as a patriarch or share a little bit about more what it means to give voice to the spirit of prophecy, and just sort of help us remind ourselves where we kind of began here when we talked about the prophetic nature of a patriarchal blessing. I'd love just to have your voice on that, and whatever you'd want to share kind of be our close here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure I can add a lot to what Jared and you have just said. I would just say that my own patriarchal blessing, I read to all of my grandchildren and children one of our recent reunions, and in it it says that my descendants will be men and women of worth down to the last generation. And I said that means you, and it had some impact on them. So I think there's great value in finding words in our experience that we set apart from ordinary words, that are, we somehow say these are God's words to us, and they can galvanize our powers. They can direct us. They can humble us and make us better people. So I'm very grateful for the provision that these patriarchal blessings can come to every last one of us, and that we can hold on to them. I think I've talked to people who carry them around. You probably have heard of this, in their wallets, and read them as scripture. There's people in this world who need something to grasp just to get them through everyday life. And the patriarchal blessing provides that for them.
And you're comfortable with that, that it does serve that way. And if somebody has taken that in the wrong or too literally or too strong a way, what would you say if you were to meet somebody who says, but it didn't come true exactly the way mine says? I guess I'm just asking you to kind of re-say what you said early in the podcast as we come to a close here, just in different language.
Well, I'm just saying that there are parts that seem to have pointed a path that you did not take. Wait, you still don't know what those words mean. And above all, don't cast off the whole blessing, because there's some part that troubles you now. It's too much of a resource. You want to hold on to it and get as much as you can from the good parts. I think Jared has said that there are parts he can't understand, but there are other parts he cherishes. And I think that's true for the scriptures. Even the most ardent believer in the scriptures has passages that are more useful to them than others that they really hold on to. And I think we all need to evaluate and hold fast to those things which are good in our lives.
Thank you so much. Jared, any final thoughts to add? Just towards Richard or anything? Let's not go super substantive.
Right. I have really appreciated this time talking about an important topic, and sure appreciate you participating, Richard. It has been a pleasure to interact with you again.
Thank you both, my brother, and I enjoyed it.
You guys have been wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. And listeners, we appreciate all that you're doing to support the podcast, and hope that you will continue to think of us in all the different ways, everything, and especially contributing to the conversation that happens at our blog, sharing your experiences, connecting with each other. Somewhere in that mix, I think there were some neat things that Richard said today about this testimony and that testimony and this experience and that experience, and somehow or other, none of them capture it all, but together as a community, we really do get to some important things, and it just testifies to this importance of being connected with each other. And so we're grateful that we've got this community built around this podcast, Mormon Stories, and different things, and we hope that you'll continue to jump in and share yourself with others as you do. So, brethren, thanks very much, and we wish you a good night tonight.
Thanks, and good night. One quick comment, Dan. I like the way you framed it, and this is one thing I believe academically and spiritually and socially, that as we all share our truths, we come closer to the truth, and I like that.
Very cool. Thanks. We'll let those be the last words. Good night, everybody. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
And joy.